Tonight on Arena, Lancome on their National Disgrace event at the Abbey Theatre, and we look at the documentary My Rembrandt with Jessica Pfaff. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. At a time when arts events are beginning to come back in some kind of live form, it's particularly pleasing to see the re-emergence of Galway 2020 European Capital of Culture. They announced today a reimagined programme to run from next month until March 2021, featuring 350 artists and headlined by Galway favourites Machnas and Druid. Marlon Gahan-Redden is the head of programme for Galway 2020 and she joins me now. Now, your trials and tribulations in Galway putting together the 2020 programme has been well rehearsed here and other places, Marlon. But I mean, even on top of that, to be hit by the pandemic then in the spring, what is the mood in the camp now going into this reimagined event?
Resilience. The mood today, to be honest, Kay, was one of joy and relief, I think, particularly amongst our cultural partners and our artists who've been on this journey with us for 4 years. So for them to get an opportunity to realise their collective creative vision is just substantial. And I suppose at a time when we need it most, art is just at the heart of what we do. And as you rightly know yourself, the show must go on. So that's the collective mood, I think, in the camp today. The show must go on.
Yes, and it's fantastic that it is. Now, we talked to Nolene Kavanagh of Machnas before, and as I said, it's one of the highlights of the festival. Yeah. And this is their fantastic show, Gilgamesh. Now, This has had to recalibrate itself in the light of the pandemic.
It has, like many of the projects, and I think what's amazing is Nolene Kavanagh, obviously one of the country's best creative directors, is still going to tell the magnificent story of Gilgamesh. And it's never been more relevant. I mean, it is an amazing story about the dance of humanity, our loves, our losses and our challenges and indeed our hopes. And Gilgamesh is epic and Machnas does epic really, really well. So what we can expect is a beautiful telling of this story in very, very different and unusual ways, digital, online, and beautiful happenings across the city and the county, done in only a way that Machnas can do, and in a story and in a manner that only Nolene Kavanagh can pull together. And they've done an incredible job reimagining Gilgamesh.
And now there's another event called Hope It Rains, and again, Given the effect the rain had on your opening event, I think you're fantastically ambitious to do this. This is by Rina Neal. Can you describe that?
Rina Neal has curated a really beautiful programme within our programme of commissions, responses, workshops, both online and offline, installations and beautiful commissions that respond to bad weather. It rains a lot. It rains a lot in Galway. So rather than focusing on the negative, let's celebrate. So this project celebrates rain in all its glory. And some of the commissions are light and fun and interesting. There's wonderful participatory workshops for children. There's water fights. And all the while acknowledging that climate change is a very serious issue. And I think Rianach has, along with the 30 or so odd artists involved in Hope It Rains, she really has curated a beautiful programme that really kind of celebrates bad weather.
Now, it's Galway City and Galway County, and the islands have not been forgotten. Inishere is going to be the venue for a big event.
Well, yes, there's a number of events across the islands, and our beautiful artist Louise Manifold will take over the island of Inishere during September with a wonderful project called Aerial Sparks, where a number of artists have engaged in residencies on board the Celtic Explorer over the last number of years, the ship owned by the Marine Institute. And it's a response to water, but through sound. So there's a wonderful exhibition in Arasena and at the lighthouse and indeed throughout the island. And Louise, again, has curated a very beautiful programme in relation to aerial sparks. And it's a really beautiful exhibition yes. and sound installation.
Yes, we talked to Louise there a few months yeah. ago. Well, we're so excited that you're up and running again. Marlon Gahan-Redden, thank you so much for talking to us. And for further details about Galway 20, go to galway2020.ie. Well, it's Thursday night on Arena, which means it's time for movie reviews. Up for review this evening is Spree, where a hopeless social media influencer decides to poison his passengers in his car and stream it all live in the hope of more followers. Next, we have a new version of Pinocchio starring Robert Benigni as a lonely carpenter, Geppetto. And finally, Sputnik brings us sci-fi horror from Russia as a cosmonaut returns from space, a space mission with an extraterrestrial baggage. Joining me are Tara Brady and Daryl Jones. We'll start with Spree. Tara, Spree centres around this character, Kurt Kunkel, played by Joe Keery, the people will know from Stranger Things. He's a wannabe influencer. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, like, why is he failing so badly to be a social influencer?
Well, he's really a classic kind of loser, but he's just streaming all the time. He's very much, he's an archetype that's, you know, become increasingly familiar in news stories for all the same reasons. He's a kind of bag of sort of toxic masculinity and incel vibes, and he's unloved, and he takes his social ineptness out on others, and it comes to a head with this planned killing spree.
How does he go, Tara, from this kind of loser to taking on such a major decision that the only way he's going to be an influencer is to kill people?
Well, I suppose he has a lot in common with the other recent social influencer comedy and dark comedy, Ingrid Goes West. It's people who are completely and utterly wrong-headed, and like his wrong-headedness is a huge part of the film. But also, like, towards the end of the film, and I don't want to spoil anything, you see a whole bunch of reactions on Reddit, on different social media platforms, and you realize, like, you know, this is sort of he's perfectly not normal, but he certainly fits into the culture that has molded him. And we've seen that as well in another film, Eighth Grade, which is much more gentle about it. But that sort of hopeless person who's kind of, you know, throwing a message in a bottle out into the world via YouTube, and it doesn't necessarily mean that anybody is ever going to pick it up. And as things happen, and as he goes along, I mean, even his more extreme actions, they find it hard to grow the audience that he wants, because, you know, the internet's a big and wild and wacky place, and it's very hard to be heard even when you shout very loudly.
Let's hear a clip from the film. Here, Kurt, played by Joe Keery, picks up his first passenger or victim, a white supremacist, Frederick, played by Linus Phillips, who has been working on a speech for a large convention.
Uh-huh. Well, I've been working on a speech all day, so this sucker's drained.
A speech? Big event?
About 3,000 people.
3,000 people? That's a lot of eyeballs on you.
Yeah. A lot of people are excited, so...
Actually, you want to tell my followers how you grew your audience? That would be great.
What do you mean, your followers?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm actually just recording a tutorial.
That's cool. About what?
Oh, I'm giving people tips on how to, like, up their social media game.
LMFAO. Very cool. While you're driving, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
It's good to see men like us trying to master this, you know, social media stuff. We're gonna need it.
Yeah. What do you mean, men like us?
White men. You are white, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. It's good. Say it with me. I'm white and I'm proud.
No.
Wait, are you Jewish?
Whites, blacks, Asians, Latinos, we're all the same.
Okay.
So that's rather a nice first passenger there. That's Frederick, played by Linus Phillips, the first passenger for Spree driver, Kurt, played by Joe Keery. Daryl, so we can see that he might turn against somebody like Frederick. Is there a moral choice that he's making all the time in the people he picks up and disposes of?
Well, this is the question I was asking myself. I kept asking myself as I was watching the film. And one of the disturbing things about the film for me is that I came to the conclusion that the answer is no. The film has a kind of refusal of meaning. So I did wonder whether Kurt wasn't a sort of carrying out some sort of twisted moral agenda. Is he a righteous avenger? You know, in the same way that Travis Bickle, and you got Kurt Kunkel, Travis Bickle, in the same way that Martin Scorsese, says his taxi driver, sees himself. You know, the people that he kills are in their various different ways awful. They're vile, they're vacuous, the white supremacists we've just met, there's a sexist sleazebag, and even the ones that are not actively horrid, you know, there are empty thrill seekers, online influencers. So I did wonder, you know, is this film a kind of vicious satire? But I think in the end that was just me imposing a meaning on the film. The point is, I think, that in this world, in Kurt's world, and that's the name of his social media site, in Kurt's world, everyone is like this. Kurt's world is everyone's world. So we're all just as culpable.
Tara, the film uses a number of techniques, found footage, split screens, lots of text messages, and then we hear from other influencers and there's like something ticking away saying whether he's losing influencers or gaining them. To what effect are these techniques used?
Well, they're actually done very well. I mean, and this has been a problem in cinema for, you know, 20 years and longer, is how to visualize and how to make the computer, your computer, your ordinary laptop, your mobile phone, whatever it might be, cinematic. I think this film does it very well. We've seen with a couple of the films that have been produced by Timur Bekmambetov over the last few years, where he has this kind of high concept. For example, Searching with John Cho, which was a very effective thriller, which was done entirely with him just staring into a laptop and trying to find out where his daughter was. So this is just as effective as that, I would say, and very much aimed at a kind of more. It's a much kind of younger demographic even than that. It has a very TikTok ADD jumpiness about it in the way that the cameras are incorporated. But in terms of its central high concept of Kurt actually streaming this as it goes, I think it carries that off without too many cheats, and I think it does a very good job.
So it's a very nihilistic film, isn't it, Daryl?
Yes, it is. A nihilistic film and a film about amorality, if not an amoral film. You know, the Kurt's followers are egging him on to worse and worse atrocities. This is a question, and it's not a new question. The question the film asks is, you know, what happens when your actions have no consequences? What happens when you are completely anonymous, completely invisible? Do you go mad? Do you break through all boundaries of propriety?
So marks out of 5 for that. Does it make that an uncomfortable watch?
Oh, for me, I suspect I'm too old for this film. I find it absolutely terrifying and disturbing. I mean, in its shallowness, in its vacuity, I think 3.5.
3.5. And from you, Tara?
I would have to say 3. I think, I mean, obviously it wants to have its cake and eat it a little bit, in that it's quite gleeful about some of the killing and the splattering. But, you know, that it's a B movie, and that's what B movies are supposed to do.
And a number?
3.
Oh, 3. 3 and 3.5 for Spree. Next tonight, we have an Italian live-action version of the classic tale of Pinocchio, starring Life is Beautiful's Roberto Benigni. Daryl, this is a classic story. The wooden puppet who wants to be a real boy, whose nose grows longer the more lies he tells. But who is the director, Matteo Garrone?
I'm not actually sure. I think this might be a question for Tara. I confess I knew nothing about the film coming into it, and it only dawned on me towards the very end, and I'm glad I didn't know, in fact, that this was Roberto Benigni I was watching.
Right, Tara, tell us a little bit about Matteo Garron.
He's very well known in terms of European film. He's won very many European film awards, and he's also won several at Cannes. But his first big international film would have been Gomorra, the big muscular mafia drama, which came out in 2008. I mean, his subsequent films are really, really interesting because they marry both quite gritty things, as that film did, set in among the Naples mafia scene, and also then the fantastic. So his 2015 film Tale of Tales, for example, with Salma Hayek, is a collection of stories by the Italian poet and courtier Giambattista Basile. And that's a more obvious precursor for Pinocchio. And we're also told that Pinocchio is a passion project for Garron. I mean, he's been trying to get this made for a great many years. That's usually a very dangerous sign because, as we know, the history of cinema is littered with big vanity projects like Heaven's Gate or The Postman. And also, the history of cinema is littered with expensive flops that are inspired by Pinocchio, the 1883 children's book. And the best known version that we have in this part of the world is the Disney one from 1940. And it was a catastrophe studio in 1940. And Roberto Benigni, interestingly, who's back in 2002, when he had Hollywood at his feet and Harvey Weinstein very much in his corner, who at that point was the most powerful man and producer in Hollywood, he scored a spectacular bomb with his own passion project of Pinocchio at that point, which was the most expensive film in Italian cinema's history. And it still has, I think, 0% on Rotten Tomatoes and won him the Golden Raspberry for Worst Actor.
Okay, Darl, this Pinocchio, at the heart of the story is fairly unsettling because it's about bringing a bowl boy to book, isn't it? How dark is this version?
It's very dark. I mean, I think it's quite faithful to Collodi's original. But one of the things that means is that it's a very, very moralistic film. You know, obey your parents. Always do as you're told. You know, don't follow your heart. Stay where you belong. Never leave home. Always go to school. These are the morals. This is the morality that the story teaches us. And I kept asking myself as I was watching this film, you know, who is it for? I don't think it's a children's film, although some children might enjoy watching it. It's a very weird and a very scary and a very disturbing and a very dislocating film. Throughout, and at times I think it's genuinely scary. There's a scene in Thailand where the bold boys are abducted by a grinning evil man who kidnaps them and turns them into donkeys to sell at the market. And this is really, really nightmarish.
But you do say that it conjures up the world of the marvellous, and it is a beautiful film to watch, even though it's unsettling. Each frame is like a painting.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous to watch. The exteriors, the countryside is beautiful. The landscapes and the townscapes are beautiful. The interiors, the part of it takes place in a kind of fairy's house, is lovely. And it does belong to a tradition of what I like to think of as magical cinema. I mean, Cocteau's La Belle et la Bête, Beauty and the Beast, is the most obvious precursor for this film and the film that I think it's trying to be at various points. But there are others as well. The Company of Wolves, for example, but these are often very grown-up and quite disturbing films. At times it reminded me of the films of Guillermo del Toro, and I was interested to discover that del Toro is also working on a new adaptation of Pinocchio. So it's clearly a film that a certain kind of sensibility keeps returning to.
Yes, Tara, extraordinarily beautiful, very unsettling. We're not too sure who it's geared at. Did you think it was like La Belle et la Bête, or were you more questioning of it?
No, I would say I'm perfectly happy to live in a world where every film is striving to be Cocteau's the Beauty and the Beast. But I actually found the Toyland scene a lot less unsettling than the version in the Disney film, which I found absolutely terrifying, still find absolutely terrifying. And I found this version a little bit less. I think one of the interesting things about Garonne is he casts a lot of non-professional actors, so he goes for people with very, very interesting faces. But one of the things that I think, and one of the reasons I think children won't be as scared of this one, is that they don't use CGI and they use prosthetic makeup and practical special effects. And that, I think, is a masterstroke, because for at certain moments, when you first see, for example, David Morata's talking cricket, you're like, oh my God, what the heck is that? But once you settle into it, you're not saddled with that thing that's been a problem in cinema for about a decade, where you have, and more than a decade, that kind of dead-eyed uncanny valley effect that, you know, hasn't really improved since Robert Zemeckis made CG humans in The Christmas Carol and Polar Express. So I think the practical special effects save it from proper creepiness, and it makes you feel all the time like you're looking at like wood cuttings or actually reading something from a book of fairy tales.
So Tara, I
would have some confidence in children. I think it's the kind of film, if I saw if it was a kid, I'd go and I'd draw it obsessively for weeks afterwards.
So would you recommend it, and how many stars would you give it, Tara?
I definitely recommend it. Oh, sorry, is that for Daryl?
No, for you, yeah.
Oh, for me, I would definitely give it 4. And yeah, I mean, if kids are sensitive, maybe, but you know, braver kids should be absolutely fine, I think.
Daryl, and you?
I can't get over the scene where, you know, they try to drown the donkey Pinocchio. I was very upset by that. 3.5.
Poor Daryl. 3.5 and 4. That's for Pinocchio. Lastly, we have Sputnik, a Soviet-era sci-fi thriller set in an army facility with an unwanted guest. Daryl, it's 1983 and a doctor from the USSR has been sent to a military base in Kazakhstan to investigate a cosmonaut recently returned from a space mission. What's at stake here?
What's at stake here is that the cosmonaut seems to have brought something back with him, and we don't know initially what the problem is. She's told by the sinister Colonel Semiradov that she has access to 90% of this remote research station, but it's the last 10%, of course, that makes all the difference, and it transpires that the cosmonaut is a host for a deadly alien life form that comes out at night. It's a brain eating parasite is what it is. It's more than that in fact. But also that the Colonel is conducting very, very, very unethical experiments on prisoners because he sees, you know, in this alien life form the possibility of a new Soviet bioweapon.
Yes, Tara, we have the alien that is within the cosmonaut's body and comes out late at night. But there's also other issues, the idea of parenthood being at issue with the cosmonaut. Does that work, this kind of deeper themes?
Not really. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going. I mean, they do enough to differentiate it from Aliens has cast a long long shadow across cinema. And like every year or so, or every few months, there's a new version of it. Like most recently, we've had Life and we had Underwater earlier this year. It has that symbiotic relationship rather than a host, or it should do. We know that can be mined very well. It was used for over many seasons in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, for example. But they don't really mind that. I think where it does go right though is. And I was thinking about Alice Winnicourt's Proxima that came out in cinemas just a few weeks ago. One thing that that film did was it brought you to the European Space Agency, and it brought you to Kazakhstan, and it brought you to Star City outside Moscow. And it worked as a kind of corrective to the fact that we're so used to looking at NASA and the Wright stuff and that kind of aesthetic when we think about space travel. So the actual Soviet era stuff, I found that really textured, and I really liked looking at it, and I sort of wanted more of that. The monster was okay, though. He looked sort of like a gremlin, and then he didn't really do anything mischievous.
And
it did feel like there was a lot squished into it.
Yes, and Daryl, I mean, the alien does a few rather nasty things, but he's not the most monstrous creature in Sputnik. Tell us about Colonel Samuradov.
Yeah, I mean, like many films of this kind, you know, we end up asking, well, who are the real monsters here? So the alien does what it does. It comes out at night, and what it does happens to involve eating brains. And there's a convoluted, spurious scientific logic here that we are told that it lives on cortisol produced in the human brains during moments of great fear. But really, you know, we're in B-movie territory here. This is, as I said, a brain-eating parasite. But it isn't actively evil. Whereas, you know, the colonel who is using prisoners and under his care as well, as experimental corpses, basically, is a monstrous, and actually in some ways quite a terrifying figure. He's the latest in a line of there's a great tradition, I think, of cinematic mad colonels who do their stuff, you know, in far flung outposts of empire or wherever. You know, I'm thinking of Colonel Kurtz, far up river in Apocalypse Now, you know, completely loosed from any kind of moral boundaries, and Colonel Samuradov says that he fully expects to be court-martialed for what he's doing here, and in fact he's rather surprised that he hasn't been already.
Tara, B movie it may be, but there's good performances.
Yeah, I think there are good performances, particularly by Fedor Bondarchuk as the colonel. And as you probably know, he's in fact a director. He directed the 2013 version of Stalingrad, which reminded me a little bit of this film, because it's one of those films that sort of takes big swings and wants to be Titanic, wants to be a disaster movie, it wants to be a creature movie, it wants to be a kind of quasi romance. But I thought Oksana Akashina was very, very good, and in as the doctor, and even though the film can be a little bit of a dog's dinner in places, they all managed to sort of hit their marks very, very well.
So stars out of five, Tara, for Sputnik.
I'd be happy enough to go with three.
Three. And you, Darl?
Oh, I loved everything about this film, from its Soviet aesthetic to its monster, to its performances, to its shamelessly derivative score, which lifts from Brad Fiedel's Terminator score. Absolutely. But I loved it also. Four and a half.
Four and a half. Yes, I liked it too. Tara Brady and Darl Jones have been watching Spree, Sputnik and Pinocchio. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. A National Disgrace is the title of a special one-off event taking place at the Abbey Theatre this weekend and featuring the acclaimed Irish four-piece Lancome. The title of the event, A National Disgrace, takes its inspiration from the righteous reaction to the 1926 premiere of The Abbey at the Abbey of Sean O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars. W.B. Yeats went on stage and said to the audience, "You have disgraced yourselves again." Lancome will take to the same stage this Saturday, performing selected music from their three albums to date, alongside some of the collaborators that have helped them on their musical journey over the years. And I'm joined by two of the members of Lancome, Dara Lynch, who does vocals, percussion, piano, and Rady Pete, who does vocals, banjan, concertina, harmonium, and a lot of other musical instruments. Dara and Rady, thank you very much for joining us. Dara, explain that the origins again of A National Disgrace. What happened that night and what did it mean for you?
We're just kind of looking into the history of the Abbey and just there's so many little different kind of nuggets and tidbits of really fascinating kind of stuff that has gone on there over the years. But the one that really stuck with us was the Yeats going out on the stage and screaming at an audience in the middle of a riot. And the audience was rioting apparently just because the play, they considered the play so offensive. It was just like there's prostitutes singing songs, there's like horrendous language, kind of like bad language of the day, and they couldn't handle it and they went berserk. And Yeats had to come out and try and calm it down by screaming his head off at them.
Yes, I mean, really, I suppose it seems like, yes, maybe the audience did make a disgrace of themselves, but there is a sense that people were really engaging with art and feeling viscerally angry about it.
Yeah, I think that's another way of looking at that story, is like it's to do with the power of art, you know what I mean? And that's just a negative reaction. But if you're provoking people, if you're inciting people to riot just with a play, then I would say you've written a fairly good play. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. And do you think that idea of, you know, as Yeats went on there and tried to defend Sean O'Casey's right to write these plays about the very people that were living in Dublin City at the time, do you think that what he was doing was something that we need to do today to defend that artistic vision, to defend against all kinds of negative reaction?
Well, I think that you should be able to honestly write whatever, you know, whatever art form you're working in. You need to be able to be honest and write what you actually want to write and express what you actually want to express. And I think that being, you know, curtailed by norms of the day, or maybe, you know, manners of the day, is probably not a good idea during any time in history.
Apparently it was almost all curtailed by subsidies from the government. Apparently the board of the Abbey at the time had a discussion and somebody was saying maybe we shouldn't put this play on as it is because the subsidies we get from the government might be stopped because it's so offensive. And Lady Gregory apparently turned around and said, given the choice between the subsidy and our freedom, I'm going to choose our freedom.
Yeah, cool. So it was all happening there on the stage, those kind of the things that you always fear is going to go on maybe in the arts, you know, pressure coming on you because of whatever you decide to air. And now Saturday's event seems to be more than just a simple live streaming of a gig. Far from it.
Yeah, well, that's the plan anyway.
Okay, so how much can you tell us about it, Dara?
I don't know, it's a weird one because we kind of want to let people know that it is definitely not just a standard kind of live stream concert, but also we really don't want to give too much away because it's going to be kind of bonkers.
Okay, so you can tell us about the start. How do people get there? People buy tickets, but it's an online event.
Yeah. So it's an online event and you kind of log in and so you're the viewer and it's going to begin as a kind of point of view kind of adventure where you're going off into town in a taxi. And I suppose I can give this one bit away, is that the taxi driver is going to be my father, who is a taxi driver in real life. And so he's going to bring you to the Abbey. And then the usher is a very special guest. And then everyone from there on in is going to be kind of specially selected guests. And it's going to kind of get more and more kind of surreal and kind of psychedelic as the evening progresses.
Right. OK. And what people have you got to help you create this vision, Rady?
Well, it's obviously a bigger undertaking than just going and playing a gig, you know. So we have a production company called The Tenth Man are helping us to envision it all. And Foggy Notions, Leagues O'Toole, is promoting the concert. Well, sorry, I don't know what to call it even. It's a performance, it's
show.
A broadcast, it's an experience. And then our manager, Keane Lawless, has done Trojan work on it as well. He's really helped. So we've pulled a lot of people together, even just from the technical point of view. And as we were saying, there's a lot of people involved, but we kind of don't want to give away too much about it. I will say, though, that we, like our last album, The Live Long Day, this will be the first time that everyone who was a guest musician on that album is actually going to play it.
Right.
They play all their parts.
Okay.
So
and will there be a performance at the end of the taxi ride, the walking around the theatre, meeting the usher?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it, like you can expect, we've curated two pieces of music too. Like it's different to our gigs because we wanted to, the whole thing was that like the live stream concerts, it's very, you're never really going to recreate what it's actually like to be in a gig, you know, or a concert performance live. But then you have these other tools at your disposal, kind of like that, you know, bringing in that kind of other world element or like things that couldn't happen in real life, you know. But it is like essentially it's a musical experience, though, the whole thing, as well as a visual one. It is meant to be an immersive and musical kind of journey.
And Dara, when you were sitting down with the creatives now who have created this, what were the kind of conversations? Because these must be the conversations, if not happening now, they're going to be happening in the next few months as we have to cope more and more with the pandemic.
Yeah, I suppose a big part of it was looking at, obviously, as Riley was saying, there's like restrictions that come along with the fact that you can't have live gigs. So you're kind of restricted in maybe putting on gigs online, having these kind of live stream gigs. But that also opens up different possibilities and opportunities. So to kind of explore them a little bit and how you can kind of take that and just take it in a different direction and maybe make it a little bit more, introduce elements of like film or theatre or that kind of stuff into it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I've always found your performances not theatrical, but I suppose maybe it's the array of instruments that you use, Rady. You know that it's you're kind of brought into a very intimate setting at a Lancome gig.
Well, I think we always like part of the way we try put together music is we are trying to create worlds, you know what I mean? Sort of audio worlds that you go into and you hopefully will get kind of some internal imagery from it. But it's meant to be like, yeah, its own world basically. So this is just a more extended version of that. It's a more fully fledged other world.
And the music then, is it the music of The Live Long Day or will it sound a little different? Have you done anything with that, Dara?
We're going to have, some of the songs will be from The Live Long Day, some will be from the previous two albums before that. But we've kind of arranged it in such a way with Spud, John Spud Murphy, who's our producer, sound engineer, in a way that the songs are going to, basically the concert will be in two halves and it'll be, all the songs will be connected by various kind of sound pieces and dronescapes, and we've kind of constructed it in such a way so you go in the whole first half, all the songs stream into one another, and then there's the interval and you kind of go wander off into a magical mystery world adventure, and then you come back for the second half of the gig again.
Well, look, we can't talk about The Live Long Day without playing The Wild Rover, I think, to bring us into that wonderful Lancome world. Wild Rover, I'll give it all. Wild Rover, I might never be golden. Wild Rover, no more. That's Lancome and The Wild Rover from The Live Long Day. And I've been talking to Dara Lynch and Rady Pete, both of Lancome. And Lancome will be performing on stage at the Abbey Theatre this Saturday, August the 15th. And the event is entitled A National Disgrace. Tickets are priced €12. And you can find full details on the website dice.fm. It's just coming up to 7:50. We may think of the greatest of all masters, Rembrandt, as parked in the days of glory of the Dutch Golden Age. However, a new documentary, My Rembrandt, shows us what a living presence Rembrandt is in the lives of many art lovers. In the documentary, we hear owners describing their love of Rembrandt, the ones they live with. We see descendants of sitters captured in paint by Rembrandt now using their expertise to acquire newly found works. And we see in Europe how the acquisition of great works of art can almost cause an international incident. Jessica Fahey has been watching it for us. We'll play a clip first, Jessica.
Sure.
Here is Richard Scott, the 10th Duke of Buchlo, and he's describing with great passion the Rembrandt painting that has been in his family's collection for many years, Old Woman Reading.
She's reading the book like this, but if she looked up, you wouldn't be in any way surprised. It's so tangible, the presence. Do you know where there's moments when you almost think you're going to, you know, it's a deeply emotional feeling. It sort of you go, you involuntarily, you know. How does he do it? I don't know. But, you know, I think we feel it, don't we, from our deepest subconscious.
That's the Duke of Buchlo talking about his beautiful Rembrandt, Old Woman Reading, and that's from the new documentary, My Rembrandt. Jessica Fahey has been watching it. It's made by a woman called Oke Hoogendijk, and there's many elements. So that's the first element, these people who live with Rembrandt paintings. So describe that painting. It's a beautiful painting.
It is a beautiful painting. And one of the things that really comes across, even just listening to that clip there, is the way that people almost feel like these are living presences in their lives. And these paintings become people that they grow up with and that they have these almost impossible to describe feelings for. So one of the things that's so great about this film is that they explore those aspects of ownership while also, through wonderfully subtle editing, explore maybe the less romantic aspects as well. So I think with that particular painting, because it's a very intimate painting, it's a woman who's looking down at a book and it's lit in this quite dramatic way, and it's a little bit later in terms of Rembrandt's career. So it has a bit more of that sort of darker drama to it. And you see how the owner tries to find the best place in his multi-roomed house in order to place it, because he wants it to be even more intimate. And we start to realise that some people are that lucky to have this painting as their close companion, and that some paintings perhaps work best in that context too, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and now the Duke is filthy rich, and your initial reaction might be to dislike him. But in fact, he talks so wonderfully about the painting, you kind of get over his billionaire status.
Absolutely. And when he carries the painting around, he always says her rather than it. So you get this, you know, sense that you kind of tune in with his joy and love that he gets from the painting. And I think that's why maybe we might start off thinking one way when he talks about the fact that he has 200,000 acres in Scotland and all these houses. And then you realise that he is still just human, and his human connection with that painting is what highlights that to us. So our own prejudices perhaps are revealed to us too as we watch.
Now, if we thought he was wealthy, then there's Baron Erich von Rothschild. Mm-hmm. And Rothschild is having some tax problems, and he has two wonderful paintings, and we're just going to hear him talking about them. It's a newlywed couple, yes, and he has them hung beside Rothschild's own bed.
They were in my bedroom, yes, they were in my bedroom. Every time I went to bed, I had Madame was just on the right of my bed and Monsieur on the left. And I always liked Obshed much more than the husband. I think that Rembrandt was interested in Obshed, and I don't think he was very interested in Monsieur. I think he found Monsieur a little bit boring, and over a little bit arrogant way. Madame was, and I'm sure she was very intelligent too.
So we see Rothschild's bed, and then on one side there's Martin's, and then there's a portrait, and then Upagen's portrait is at the other side. And these are two huge dark paintings.
And unusual for Rembrandt, they're life-size portraits. So that wasn't something all that common within his oeuvre, because it would cost so much to do it, to paint it. And these are painted in the 1630s when he's still relatively young in terms of his career. So to get a commission like that would have been extraordinary. What I love is that although within the sort of Puritan, you know, Netherlandish provinces, you had to wear black and white, they wear the most expensive version of black and white. And he has Martin Sulman's has these lace pom-poms on his shoes, which are extraordinary, and she's wearing lots of pearls. So even though they look maybe dark and demure from a distance, the closer you see, the more you realise just how wealthy they are. And then Rothschild's bed, which is an antique bed, single antique bed, is positioned in between these two extraordinary paintings.
Now, these are the two paintings that almost cause an international incident. How did that happen between the Dutch and the French?
Yes. So this is one of the things, again, that this film does so well, which is highlights all of those things where we sort of have an expectation of who's worthy to own what. And we sort of assume that within that, things going to the public collection makes, you know, the best sense and is the fairest for all. Whereas the way it's edited, you see that the Louvre in Paris and the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam are battling over this, these two paintings. They want them to stay together. The Dutch want them to return to Amsterdam where they're painted. They were purchased by the Rothschilds in the 19th century, so in 1870s. So the Louvre want them to stay in Paris because that's part of their history too. And initially they're going to buy them together. And then the Rijksmuseum raises the majority of the money, only to find out that the Louvre hasn't raised anything, until their minister steps in and is going to stop the paintings being allowed to leave the country at all. So they have to come to an agreement. And again, the way that this is presented by Hoogendyk, the filmmaker, is she has them bicker behind the scenes at each other, and then it cuts straight to the public event where they're all smiles and all lovey-dovey, and it really cuts to the core of that world.
Yes, and the Dutch are going, we nearly had it.
Exactly.
We
shouldn't have said a word. No, it's fantastic.
Now, Jan Six is a famous name when it comes to Rembrandt. So, and then a descendant is a famous, or is one of the central characters, if not the central character, in My Rembrandt. So could you tell us about the painting and then where this guy fits in?
Yes, absolutely. So in the 1640s, Jan Six was very good friends with Rembrandt, and Rembrandt portrayed him in a few different mediums. But the most famous is an oil painting where he has this extraordinary sort of red cloak over this brown, sort of greyish brown jacket with these yellow buttons. But the thing that's so interesting about it is that rather than typical portraits of the time, which are very static, Jan Six is pulling on a glove and he's about to walk out. So we get this sense that one, Rembrandt knew him, knew his personality, knew that he was all business. And we get this real great insight into someone who lived, you know, in the 17th century because of the way that Rembrandt portrays him. And then in this film, we actually see the 11th, 10th and 11th, in fact, Jan Sixes. So the name continues through the family, and they still own the original painting, and they have, you know, they position themselves in front of it for family photographs and all of these kind of things. But what you start to realise is with Jan Six the 11th, who's the youngest one, who works as an art dealer, is that there's something almost that he feels he needs to prove, to step out of the shadow of this very famous painting that his namesake is, you know, involved in, and that in a way he needs to kind of prove himself. And
yes, he says he has to be five times better than any other art aficionado. And he is. He's deep. deeply knowledgeable about Rembrandt paintings.
Oh, absolutely. What was fascinating is, again, the personal relationship. So himself and his father, Jan X, are bickering over whether or not painting is about feeling and emotion with the viewer and the connection, or whether it's about the sort of scientific interrogation of a painting. And the younger, of course, falls on that side because he's an art dealer. And initially, you're very much on his side and you want to, you know, see him succeed and you see his passion and his enthusiasm. But the sort of intrigue of the film starts to get more complex and complicated as his story further unfolds. And again, kind of a bit of a sort of national event in the Netherlands, what ultimately happens within that story.
What I found amazing was that it could make the uncovering, if that's the right word, of a Rembrandt that they think is hidden behind a lesser known painting, mm-hmm. that they can make that dramatic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary. And when you look at the difference in prices, in particular. So the Rothschilds, for example, selling those two paintings, painted around about the same time as the one that Jan Six buys, so the 1630s. And Jan Six gets his Circle of Rembrandt painting of a portrait of a young man for £135,000, whereas £160 million is what the Rijksmuseum and the Louvre pay for the other pair. So that shows you the discrepancy. And it comes down to the connoisseur's eye, but also kind of convincing people. And that then raises questions, which are throughout the film anyway, of where do we find value in art? Is it monetary? Is it the feelings we get? All of these things are raised.
Jessica, is he the greatest Rembrandt?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Hard to say.
Up yeah. there, though.
Yes, up there. Yeah.
And I think my Rembrandt is a really good, well, introduction to Rembrandt and yes. also a very exciting documentary. Jessica Fahey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. My Rembrandt
is being streamed now. That's it for tonight's Arena. Research was by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. And the programme was produced by Sinead Egan.